Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. We often hear NPR science reporter Richard Harris covering a new discovery or scientific advancement on these airwaves. But as he writes in his new book, bona fide groundbreaking biomedical research has increasingly become the exception, not the rule. Harris has been reporting for NPR since 1986. In Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions, he describes a scientific culture in which publish or perish imperatives come at the expense of truth. Richard Harris, welcome to the Roundtable.
Pleased to be here, Ian.
When did you first become aware of what you saw as this problem?
Well, I guess I had a sort of a wondering, nagging thought in the back of my head for many years as I've covered a lot of studies, thinking, are these really right, you know, or actually deciding very often that I don't trust a study in the paper and in a journal enough to actually put it on the air. So there's always been this sort of sense that not everything is right, but I didn't realize how much was wrong really until a couple of years ago when I decided to look under the hood of biomedical research and explore some of these questions in much greater depth.
Give us a sense of what you see the problem as being.
The problem has many different facets, but in general, what's happening is, well, first of all, biomedical research is a big challenge. It's hard to do. These scientists are working at the edge of knowledge, and failure is part and parcel of life. And we should accept that. We know that a lot of ideas that seem exciting at the time just don't stand the test of time. So that's all fine. But what I was looking at was asking a deeper question, which was, how much of this failure is actually avoidable? How much is caused by scientists who are making mistakes that they don't have to make? And the answer is an awful lot of the failure that is in biomedical research appears to be things that are fixable. So that's actually a hopeful message, that if people focus on the things that they can improve, we can actually accelerate this research and understand disease more rapidly and come up with better drugs more rapidly.
Now, would you say you're in the world of science? You know, you cover these people, you cover important institutions and so on. Would you say that they recognize shortcomings, or has there been some pushback to your book?
Well, I was surprised how readily people were willing to talk to me. And yes, I did get a little bit of pushback. And I think a lot of the pushback revolves around the fact that these are perilous times right now in Washington, D.C., and people are concerned about funding for biomedical research and worried that that if funding gets cut, these problems would actually get much worse. And that is a fair concern. But with that aside, I think many, many scientists recognize that this is a significant issue. In fact, Nature, the journal, ran a survey last year and asked scientists, is there a reproducibility crisis? And more than half of scientists said yes, and another 40% said, well, there's at least a slight crisis. So 90% of scientists perceive this as a crisis. And I talked to many people from Nobel laureates on through the ranks of all sorts of folks throughout biomedical research, and people like Francis Collins, who's the director of the National Institutes of Health, says, yes, this is a real problem, and we should embrace it. I think, much to his credit, he did not try to sweep this problem under the rug as it started bubbling up in recent years. He realized, this is something that I got to fix, and he's actually working hard to do that.
What is the fix?
There are multiple problems, so there are multiple fixes. But I sort of boil these down into four different categories of the problems. Scientists use bad materials. The methods that they choose to use are often misleading. They make bad assumptions about whether something is going to, if it works in an animal, whether it will work in people. And also, it's sort of at the root are these incredible pressures that scientists find themselves under as a result of the hyper-competitiveness of science right now. There's just not enough funding to go around, and scientists spend a lot of effort struggling just to keep their labs going. And that creates really bad incentives for them and discourages them from doing the best science. Sometimes they feel like they're choosing between, do I keep my career alive or do I do the very best science? And of course, they can't do science at all if they don't have a career. So those are difficult. And I'm happy to walk through those categories if you want more detail on any of the topics I mentioned.
Yes, please. Please go ahead.
Okay. So in terms of bad materials, scientists in these labs very often use cell cultures. These are cells that will grow in flasks in the lab all by their lonesome. They don't have to be attached to a human being or an animal or whatever. And it turns out that quite often these cells are not what people think they are. They get mixed up over the years. Contamination is very easy in these labs. And very often scientists who think they're studying breast cancer are actually studying, say, melanoma cells. And this is a significant problem with actually a very easy fix, because there are tests that you can run that cost a couple $100 and tells you, is this cell the melanoma cell I think it is, or is it something completely different? So that's an easy problem to fix. And in fact, last year, the National Institutes of Health said, if you're getting funding from us to do these kinds of studies, we also expect you to then validate your cell line. So I think that's in terms of a technological fix, that's the easiest, that's the low-hanging fruit here.
That was astounding to read. I'm sorry to interrupt. That was astounding to read that that they could be working on the wrong cells for years and years and years. As a layperson, I just assumed that almost couldn't happen.
Yeah, you would think so. And some of these cells are, there's a list of 451 now cell lines that are not as advertised. And you can go, any scientist can go to the internet, download this list and say, oh, is this Chang liver cell I'm working with what I think it is? And the answer is Chang liver is actually a cervical cancer cell. And if you think you're studying liver cancer, guess again. But that's, you know, there are, as I say, more than 400 cell lines that are misidentified.
Okay, so what were some of the other endemic issues you identified?
Yeah, so bad methods was another one, and one of my favorite examples of this is a technique that scientists use that's called harking, which is hypothesizing after the results are known. And this seems really benign if you're not really thinking about the subtleties of science. But say a scientist runs an experiment and doesn't quite get the result that they're thinking that they were expecting to get. Their hypothesis that they had at the outset was not found to be true once they ran the study. But then they dig around in their data a little more and say, oh, but here's some unexpected finding. This thing down here, I wasn't expecting to see, and lo and behold, it has cropped up. And therefore, I will restate my hypothesis and say, I hypothesize that if I run this experiment, I will get that result. But of course, they already know the result. And the reality is, most of the time you do that kind of thing, you end up with a false discovery. It's not really true. It was just a fluke that it happened. And the analogy I like is called the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, where a cowboy is riding along through Texas and he comes across a barn where there's a series of targets and bullseyes in every single target of bullet holes exactly in the middle of these targets. And a boy wanders out of the barn and the cowboy says, how did you Who is this amazing sharpshooter? And the little boy says, I shot those shots. And the cowboy says, wow, that's amazing. How did you do it? And the boy says, well, it was easy. I shot the barn first, and then I painted the targets around the bullets. So that is that's an analogy to what really is going on when scientists use this technique called harking, which is a sloppy method that people slide into.
That's not exactly the same as falsifying a study, though. Does that happen?
Yeah, well, falsifying does occasionally happen. As far as anyone can tell, outright fraud is a fairly rare occurrence in science. But there, a lot of these incentives are much more subtle. And what you end up doing is maybe not even acting deliberately. I think scientists who are harking aren't thinking, well, I'm going to torture my data until it talks to me. They don't necessarily think that what they're doing is wrong, but a lot of these are considered detrimental research practices, and you shave a little bit here and you shave a little bit there, it's actually surprisingly easy to get the wrong answer, or to get the answer you're expecting, which is another part of human nature that drives some of this. People really, you know, see what they want to see, whether you're a scientist or, you know, a reporter. People have these tendencies to basically to see the world through the lenses that they're used to seeing things through. And if some scientist has an exciting idea, they're always looking for data that supports that idea. And the power of science is really some of these techniques are supposed to be used to prevent you from fooling yourself. But the human nature is strong, and sometimes people just stumble into things not out of any deliberate, not out of malice, not out of deliberate cooking of data or whatever, but they're so determined that they want to see what they're hoping to find that they find ways of interpreting their data that way. And that often can lead people astray.
Much of your book centers on the question of, you know, being able to reproduce experiments down the line. is there a certain percentage of science that is done that is not reproducible for a reason other than, rushing through the lab tests or anything along those lines? Is there a natural rate of that?
I don't think you can put a number on it, but absolutely, that's a very important and essential element of science. I think failure is critical. If everything succeeded, I would say scientists aren't trying hard enough. They're not actually testing frontiers. They're not testing boundaries. They are, they're not really exploring interesting questions if the answers pop out so easily. So failure is a critical part of science, and we shouldn't expect perfection or anything resembling perfection out of science. In fact, if you talk to somebody in the laboratory, they will say 90% of the time when I'm trying to do an experiment, it fails. It's not, that's kind of an expectation that things don't work very often. But when they do work, the question is, are the results correct? And actually what I focus on in the book is asking the question about when there are failures, how many of those failures can be avoided? How many had to happen just because there are a million ways things can go wrong? And how many of them happen because of bad cell lines or bad methods or other sorts of problems that crop up and are endemic in research?
You mentioned earlier in the interview that your book, to a certain degree, could not have been timed better. We're having a national debate over what we should spend money on. Do you worry at all that some congressman could go to the floor with this book and say, NPR science reporter himself says, we're spending $30 billion a year on this stuff and it's not always working out? I mean, do you worry about becoming a prop in these debates?
Well, my response to that would be if you cut the budget for NIH, all you're going to do is make these problems that much worse. Because as it is today, if you're a scientist trying to get money out of the NIH, you have to put in 5 grant proposals on average to get one funded. This is much worse than it was even a decade or so ago. Things are getting progressively worse. And those are the pressures that are underlying a lot of these problems. So if you cut the funding, you just make these problems worse.
Give us some advice as a listener, as maybe a reader of the New York Times science section. When we hear about some great new discovery or a great advancement, how skeptical should we be on a daily basis?
I would say skepticism is always a very healthy thing to bring with you as you're reading or hearing about new scientific advances. Sometimes exciting things pan out, but very often they don't. And there was actually a paper that was published quite recently after my book went to the publishers, where some scientists in France took a deep look at this and said, they went back and they looked at a bunch of papers that had been published and that had received coverage in newspapers around the world, in English language newspapers. And they found that upon getting more information about the initial discovery, there are things like, certain pesticide is linked to Parkinson's disease, or here's a new mechanism that could explain hyperactivity disorder, or here's a virus that may be related to autism, for example. These are some of the papers that they looked at. When they went back and waited for the scientific evidence to accumulate and revisited those topics, about half of them were wrong. They did not stand the test of time. And the exciting, flashy ones that were sort of the first time ever scientists have found X, Y, and Z, about 2/3 of those turned out to be wrong. So we as news consumers need to be very cautious about following these things through because, great ideas or exciting ideas, there's a huge pressure among scientists to publish them and because it helps move their careers forward, it helps them get funding and so on. But we also have to be wary and knowledgeable that a lot of the time they don't stand the test of time.
Coffee, yay or nay?
That's a perfect example. And I think people bring that sensibility to stories about nutrition, by and large. And I think American consumers, many of them now have a fairly sophisticated knowledge. Just, we know that we can't really trust nutrition studies because is coffee good for you? It depends on the day of the week or the phase of the moon or whatever, whenever these studies come out. And I think that we need to apply some of that same skepticism to medical studies as well. Now there clearly are solid and carefully done studies that are more likely to be correct. Big, careful, huge, multi-center drug trials, for example, that are leading up to approval of a new drug, perhaps. Those tend to be much more reliable. But a lot of the initial studies about here's a new idea, maybe we can treat Alzheimer's with this new approach, most of those things simply don't pan out.
Richard Harris is science reporter for NPR. The name of his new book is Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. And it's just been a pleasure to have you on the Roundtable. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Ian. It was a pleasure to be with you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.